They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
The Street Fighter. If you've got to fight, fight dirty.
Damn, look like my women is on time.
Babe, I could show warm you up.
No shit, baby.
I can dig it.
They called her One Eye, then ran for their lives. We've got a peck of trouble.
Come on, let's get in character.
Here we go.
The day started just like any other day. The fresh October morning breeze blew across the ranch. The cattle were coming in for the morning feeding. And the buttery morning sunlight painted a golden glow through the ranch house windows. If I'd known then what was about to happen, I'd have never crawled out of bed.
Hey bastards, welcome back to the Daily Grindhouse podcast. This is G from DailyGrindhouse.com, along with the gentleman and scholar Dr. Freaks and the Creeper, also of DailyGrindhouse.com, also the assistant editor of that fine, fine piece of online cinematic pie. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to go with it anyway. How you boys doing?
Well, I'm hungry for pie now.
G's up and hoes down, my friends. Let's keep it street.
That's good advice, yes.
When you come from the rough and tumble streets as I have, you learn to keep it real, my homies.
There's no rougher place than the suburbs of Portland.
And Nashville.
Well, hey, bastards, if you survived the Things podcast, we salute you, because this week we're back in the seat and ready for the Creeper to unleash some cyborg fury from 1988. What do you have for us, Creeper?
We have ROTOR, which of course means, obviously, Robotic Officer Tactical Operation Research.
You and accused of being an accomplice in a major traffic crime assassination. I am Rotor. You are guilty.
And, I mean, I think that's self-explanatory, but for those who aren't too quick on the draw, the synopsis is as such. After a freak mishap with a member of the Thompson Twins posing as a Native American, a chubby, crime-fighting robot prototype is let loose on the streets to serve justice. COD.
Rotor. The men you put in charge, they activated it. It went out, put itself on active duty. Its last program was Prime Directive.
Shut up, Coldiron.
Prime Directive in 25, 50 years from now. Prime Directive to our Rotor unit is judge and execute. It stops felons, judges the crime, and executes sentence. Justice served, COD.
Unfortunately, its creator, a poorly dubbed scientist named Coldiron, has not yet put the finishing touches on the nearly invincible policeman who looks like Super Mario 2000, and the results prove disastrous.
Well, now I don't have to watch the movie. Great.
Yeah.
We're doing everyone a favor, then.
Yeah.
So, in a nutshell, guys, how much did you love ROTOR?
Well, let's see. Yeah, this is the second time I've watched ROTOR. The first time it was brought to a small film festival. And the audience, you know, didn't hate it because they were too busy laughing at it. And the second time, it turned out to be better than I remembered. But, you know, it's still ROTOR. It's a low-budget action flick, and why do people attempt low-budget action flicks?
The most major flaw of the film is that it takes itself so goddamn seriously.
Remember what I said at Rotor's christening? First prototype of a future battalion. On the battlefield highways of the future, you'll be the judge, jury, and executioner. Now I've got to wonder, were we playing God, breathing life into our artificial atom, or have we lost sight of paradise? What was it Milton said? Did I request thee, maker, for my clay to mold me, man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? Is it his fault he is what he is, or is it ours? Well, either way, he's out there now, 25 years too soon.
Let's go get him.
It's like showing you the most ludicrous things and these piss-poor theories in science. Then it wants to look at you with a straight face like, yeah, you're buying this, right? And no, I'm not buying this.
Yeah, to me, this thing was like, it's like a hangover, but you don't get the fun part of getting to the hangover. You're just left with a crippling, crippling headache.
I think it's nice enough, though, that the movie immediately sets the tone by having arguably the most padding in the first act that any movie I've ever witnessed dared to insult their audience with. At first, they have the little bookend with them finding Cold Iron.
Cold Iron!
Cold Iron! They find him injured on the streets, and then he gets picked up by the police, and he has to relay the story. I think it pretty much sets the tone when it starts doing that pan across the vista of his farmhouse, and he's talking about the golden glow of the buttery sunshine.
Yes, the buttery sunshine.
It makes you want pancakes.
And a buttery morning sunlight painted a golden glow through the ranch house windows.
I don't know if he was going for like Hemingway or something, and then they kind of just dropped that completely. I don't know. I'm under the impression that maybe they filmed the beginning last because they realized they had to make it close to the 90-minute mark because they have this little poetic opening, and it has Cold Iron, getting up for his morning routine, which includes taking your daily vitamins and making your coffee, which we get to watch percolate, and getting some orange juice, and walking across his lawn to give a carrot to a horse across the whole lawn, mind you. And then the wacky horse drinking his coffee, him eating the horse's carrot.
And shaking his head in disbelief. Like, can you believe this is happening again? I'm eating the horse's carrot.
Can you believe my horse? This horse must be the wackiest of all horses. But few movies dare to go the distance as far as establishing exactly how mundane everyone's morning routine is in its entirety, and I appreciated that. What did you think of the buttery glow of the beginning of Rotor?
You're right. The first 30 minutes of this movie is easily one-third montage. Montage is set to music, no less. I think I made the comment that this thing has got more driving montages than Manos, the Hands of Fate. He does do one interesting thing on his ranch. Remember, he does blow up the stump. While his voiceover informs us that normally he uses nitroglycerin for this sort of thing, but technology, blah blah blah. He's using det cord as a lasso. You're going, well, okay, I guess that there is going to mean something later.
And it does. It's foreshadowing. It's good writing.
This movie is chock full of foreshadowing. We haven't yet mentioned the fact that all this is voiceovered by Cold Iron, who is not using his own voice.
He's not. And apparently the gentleman who played Cold Iron got onto director Cullen Blaine's bad side. And in an act of rage, he completely dubbed Cold Iron in post.
That'll show him.
So it wasn't because he had a squeaky falsetto voice or, God forbid, he couldn't act.
No, I mean, obviously, he burns the screen with his charisma, and he looks like Randy West with an undying love of flannel. I mean, how could you go wrong with this guy? He was targeted unjustly, I'm assuming.
Yeah. If I were the director there, I don't know if I would have let that story go. I would have probably just said that it was the Christopher Lambert Greystoke curse. His French accent was so heavy we couldn't understand a word he was saying, so we brought in somebody in post and dubbed him. That's what I would have gone with.
So you were not convinced by Cold Iron's screen presence and his performance?
I wasn't, no. Let me walk back a little bit on this, and let me give you my history with Rotor. I've never seen this movie. I remember it clearly in the video store. I mean, I could tell you where it was located in my shop. My VCR has never been graced with the presence of Rotor. And it's been through a lot. It's been through Beast of Yucca Flats. It's been through Manos, Things, Heaven's Gate, Howard the Duck. It's been violated by Troll 2, Monster of Go-Go, you name it. But Rotor proved to be too much for the old girl last week. That film killed my 20-year-old VCR, and I think I may still be slightly pissed at Creed. But it's nothing a little one-on-one time can't fix. Wink.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this film killed the VCR. I got a new one last week and was able to watch, finally, Rotor beginning to end. I should preface my feelings by saying that I really dig bad cinema. I mean, bad music and bad books are tough to get through. But give me a bad film, and I can find a slot for that on my annual viewing list. And that may explain why Highlander 2, The Quickening, was shitting in my eyeballs over the weekend. But the reason why I like bad cinema is you can usually see, you know, the pulse and the heartbeat of the film that was trying to come through. You can see, however tortured the production, i.e. Things, what was intended, kind of. And I don't see that with this flick. I just saw kind of like this chaotic mess of partial ideas, bad acting, worse dubbing, and terrible, terrible direction. It was still fun. I still dug it. But it reminded me of the video store back in the day. We would call it a cover fuck. And a cover fuck was a VHS that would have cool box art, but it was a crap film. And the cover art on my VHS cover, anyway, is kind of this cyborg. It's Rotor, cartoonish version of Rotor. It's a cyborg guy standing on top of a crashed motorcycle. It's kind of this Clint Eastwood's The Gauntlet type cover, and you think you're in the mood for, or you think you're going to get all kinds of badass, but when you put the flick in the machine, you get driving montages, some fancy cowboy work, a hint of bestiality maybe, a mean robot whose defining acts are to not sign up for the policeman's ball, walk through a few rows of chairs, and maybe speeding through an empty parking garage. I felt the pain of Dr. Freaks' cranial headaches experienced with Things. I thought this movie was kind of painful.
Wow. I think the movie's entertaining from beginning to end, and again, it's because of that incredible heavy-handedness of the philosophy and the science portrayed in the film and how serious it wants to be taken.
In science, there's no room for human error. There's no place for it in law. We built the perfect lawman, one who could walk into the streets of blood, the cities of fire, the edge of destruction, and function perfectly, again and again. And already, look what's happened. Human error.
This diabolical, unstoppable force is really like a chubby policeman.
A great porn stash, by the way.
Who can see through time, but can't reach through a fucking window.
Right.
So
right. Or bend. Like, they forgot to teach him the art of bending. Who was the other robot? Who was the one that looked like Twiggy and Johnny Five Bump Nasty?
That is Dr. Howdling's wisecracking robotic assistant, Wheeler.
Right, right.
Who has a Simon game for a face, loves to dance, and wears an ill-fitting hat.
Mm-hmm. And is extremely insecure, because that's what you want in a robot that you built. You want them to be insecure and second-guess everything you do.
And he loves French fries. Did you hear him request Dr. Howdling's French fries? Are you going to finish that? It was hilarious.
Yes, and hilariously hitting on the receptionist.
I'm about to blow your guys' mind, but that French fry gag was completely improv. That was not in the script.
That's because Wheeler's a fucking pro, that's why.
Wheeler is a pro. In real life, Wheeler talks to young children about their problems for the police. Now, this is not a joke. He is a real robot who is obviously remote controlled. And when Billy gets the bad touch and is uncomfortable talking to the policeman, he will, in fact, talk to Wheeler and tell him about all the naughty things Uncle Billy did in the restroom at the Burger King on 5 Mile and Gallatin.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm.
You're going to forgive me if I look askance at you right now, because I'm remembering your Navajo imagery bullshit during Things.
I completely deserve that. However, this is the truth. Let me say this. Wheeler was an active duty robot for the police during the making of Rotor.
Okay.
All we got was McGruff the crime dog and a swift kick with a Wolverine boot.
That explains where Wheeler comes from, because he's really not... He doesn't really match the rest of the production.
No.
He's got kind of a professional Disney quality to him, in spite of the fact that his neck appears to be made of dryer hose.
Well, so far we've discussed three of the characters, Cold Iron, the titular Rotor, and Wheeler. And so far we're one out of three, which isn't very good, so I have to go for the ace in the hole. What did you all think of Dr. Steele?
Dr. James Steele.
I thought it was commendable that she took time from a very profitable gig with the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling to film Rotor and provide it with a little bit of substance that it so desperately needed.
Yeah, and hair coloring.
And hair coloring. And pecs.
She's a remarkable presence. You have to admit that.
I'm not sure if it's a she who's just ripped or a he who just did too much roids. Or too many roids, I should say.
That was all woman, baby.
That was all woman.
Basically, for all you listeners out there who have not yet experienced Rotor, the key word being yet, because I know you're going to run right out and pick up this bad boy on Amazon as soon as you get done listening to this podcast, probably for the third time. That's usually when the seed really takes root. What happens is that Rotor is let out into the field early due to political pressure on the aforementioned Cold Iron, the scientist who invented Rotor. And he's not done. He needs a few more years to finish, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, through a mishap, which we'll get into later because that's one of Freeman's favorite characters, Shoe Boogie, Rotor is released into the world. And he's sent out onto the streets with no perspective as far as you hold up a bank, he's going to kill you. You jaywalk, he's going to kill you. And so he's basically just going out killing indiscriminately amongst the masses, and he is unstoppable, and he can see through time, and people are aghast by his porn stash. But anyway, Cold Iron catches wind that Rotor is running rampant, and he is chasing a woman through the countryside of wherever the fuck they're filming this movie.
It's Dallas.
Oh, it's Dallas.
Dallas.
That's right.
I can testify to that.
And he's chasing this woman with the intent to kill her. And somehow Cold Iron gets a hold of her and says, keep running, I'm going to go get help. Commanding this woman to be on the lam from Rotor, who is an unstoppable killer, and he's asking her to run from this robot for the next 6 hours while he waits for his lesbian to arrive at the airport, and they can both take down Rotor together. He picks her up at the airport. They have a nice chit-chat as the drive to the hotel, so I guess she can freshen up or pump some roids.
I think it's the color of that strip, that skunk strip on her hair. You want to get that in the right, you don't want that color to be fading out on all sides of your head. You'd rather have the strip, because the strip is really what gets you when you're fighting Rotor.
So she puts on her camel pants and her wife beater, and she primps her hair, and suddenly they get this fucking sense of urgency, like, oh, we should go help this woman. It's been 6 hours. I guess we should go do something about it.
Whatever that make of car is she's driving, I want that. It gets great gas mileage.
They didn't have to stop once. That was awesome. Maybe she coasted a lot.
I think they... Yeah, she coasted.
She was hyper-miling.
It was a hybrid, but hybrids were cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they just figured that, you know, she's been on the run 6 hours. I just got off a plane. I'm sweaty. What's another 2 hours really going to be?
Really?
I think we should go out and stop Rotor, but I'm a bit peckish, and I could really go for some loaded potato skins, maybe at a Friday's. And we'll skip the appetizer, obviously.
Is there a Denny's here? I could do a Moons Over My Hand.
She gets dressed, and they get this sudden that sense of urgency. They're going to run out and save this woman from Rotor. And basically, that's about a good portion of the middle of the film, is that the chase scene. That's not depicted. We only see the airport picking up and primping scene.
Can we talk a little bit about the arch enemy of Rotor? Horn?
Yes. Let's do that. Yes.
What the hell? Like, I didn't even know what to say about that. Like, your enemy is... I mean, RoboCop had Ed 209, right? Terminator had Michael Biehn. Rotor has a car horn. Yeah, like, come on, give me some more punch.
For those of you at home who haven't seen it, yes, this is how you stop Rotor dead in his tracks. You lay on a car horn.
I'm assuming an air horn probably just put him flat on his ass.
I'm wondering why. I mean, Cold Iron, in one of the sequences when he actually catches up with Sonya and engages in some hand-to-hand with Rotor, she winds up laying on the horn again, so he's there. He witnesses this. It happens several times, and why nobody bothers to stop at a hardware store while they're checking into the hotel or something and just pick up an air horn, like you said. Well, the ending of the movie would have been, you know, a lot more anticlimactic than it already is, admittedly.
So let me ask a question. What works in this movie? You know how things had that. We talked about things last podcast, and we were talking about how, you know, these were basically two kind of metalheads who got together and they made a film. They were kind of experimenting with the craft, and we were getting to watch those experiments take place, right? With Rotor, you had – I mean, the director had done stuff previous to this film in television, and but still the result is not a good – film. It's not even a marginally good film. I mean, what's the pull here? Is it the so bad it's good category, or are there actually moments here where you think this film has something, it's just not putting it together well?
It absolutely does not work, and something that should be pointed out is that Cullen Blaine, before Rotor, only did animation. I mean, some high-end stuff, some Disney stuff.
Hanna-Barbera,
name brand animation. And after Rotor, Cullen Blaine has only done animation. So I'm thinking that, you know, it's night and day, and obviously he did not know how to put real people in a movie and make a coherent film, because nothing works in this movie. And unlike Things, it doesn't have that charm, the effort, the heart.
It's joyless. It's absolutely joyless. It doesn't look like anybody's really having a good time, which, you know, much as I despise Things, you know, these guys look like they're having a good time.
Right.
Lethal Force, when we talked about that, everybody looks like they're having the time of their lives. And it's just, it's so rote. It's just so leaden.
Actually, one person appears to be having a very good time, and he is very much the crux of the film. He is what causes Rotor to go rampant.
And by crux, you mean the character I want to strangle. Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. That is the shoe boogie, the supposed Native American, who, while hitting on one of the office assistants, inadvertently puts his switchblade comb into some mess of wires that short circuits and activates Rotor.
Say, baby, slide me them 7 digits.
The phone number, Mama. You've got to give up the phone number.
Hey, baby, look. Here I am, my bad self up in your face. You looking everywhere but here. You think you bad or something? Another white supremacist?
Shubby, you're like going too far.
Another pale face grinding his heel in the poor Indian's face. I thank God my sainted ancestors have gone off to the happy hunting grounds. I ain't around to see this racism.
You're not an Indian.
Look at these cheekbones, baby. Either I'm an Indian or I'm a sissy. And well, since, I must be an Indian.
Don't you like have some mopping to do?
But more importantly, he's just such a fascinating character. He's so multidimensional and layered. What did you think Shoe Boogie brought to this film?
He definitely brought the white man's overbite, which is criminally missing from most films that I watch. The effect of putting headphones on your ears and biting your upper lip while you're doing a mock dance around a female subject. I really did think that contributed a lot to his presence in the movie.
He could not have a white man's overbite. He was obviously a Native American. And as he said, just look at his cheekbones. He was either an Indian or a sissy.
He was one of the two. We're not sure if he was a sissy or an Indian.
I'm not sure how you should take that. If I was a Native American, I might have been offended if I heard that.
Yeah. If he was an Indian, I'm Chinese. And if he wasn't a sissy, I am, on top of that, Bruce Lee. the major thing I got from Shoe Boogie, besides, you know, my hands clenching uncontrollably with rage, is this place is so high-tech that even the janitors wear lab coats. And I have to admit, is when I was skimming through this for a third time that I realized that, Jesus. Oh, Christ, this is a janitor. This is not another scientist. Because
so you've seen this movie three times now?
Call it 2.5. When Joe pointed out the Beach Boys boardroom, I had to go out to check that out. I had to go back and check that out.
Yeah, Joe, talk about the Beach Boys boardroom.
I have to admit, like Freeman said, I had seen Rotor about two times before, and I didn't realize it on my own. I have a friend who actually is a Beach Boys fan, and obviously we're not friends anymore, but he noticed that they were referencing Beach Boys songs during the boardroom scene where Coldline is giving a presentation as to how Rotor works. And they're showing that great, I'm going to get crucified for this, Harryhausen-esque animation in the background while he discusses it. But one of the gentlemen claims he's from the Dr. Brian Wilson Institute. And they then mention such as, I'm not getting something along the lines of, I'm not getting good vibrations from this.
Yeah, the alloy is something you're getting good vibrations from.
They reference, I get around, but I've never seen this before. God only knows what. And they also mention heroes and villains, which is the only one I'm not familiar with.
What's your intent, some little-known alloy? Is there some good vibration to its molecular tonality you can utilize?
How can it animate without gears and motors? I mean, I get around, but I've never seen anything like this.
God only knows this is spectacular, but what exactly are we dealing with here?
Well, who are we who create such a thing? Heroes and villains?
The only difference between a hero and a villain is the amount of compensation they take for their services. At our pay scale, I'd say we're heroes.
Yeah, I never noticed it because I was getting I was getting blinded by the techno babble. And he pulls out some prime techno babble while that stop motion thing is bending and doing jumping jacks in the back.
My favorite line from that scene, though, is when one of the guys says, You mean to tell me that Sin could do anything from aerobics to Tai Chi? It's like he's thinking in his mind, this thing could replace Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
Someone actually sat down and wrote these philosophic diatribes, and it cracks me. I mean, I'm assuming they'd have to read through it at least twice, to just, if nothing else, to get the typos out. And again, it's almost insulting how stupid it is when they present this dialogue. They're throwing it out there like, think about it, won't you?
Yeah, I guess say my favorite line from the whole film was when, I'll make more noise than two skeletons making love in a tin coffin.
I'm pulling your plug. You're off the project as of right now.
Let me tell you something, mister. You fire me and I'll make more noise than two skeletons making love in a tin coffin, brother.
You bastard.
What the hell?
Or, you look like you got both eyes coming out of the same hole. I don't know. I don't even know what that means. Freeman, you've been around the block a few times. What the fuck does that mean?
Yeah. Get back to you on that. Now, let me go around the block a couple more times.
How about shoe boogie? I know what this means. Once you go red, you never get out of bed.
Yeah. I wish I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah, the movie has a couple of comic relief characters that they let the camera run on so they can finish their monologues. And Shoe Boogie's one of those. The guy who tries to sign up Rotor for the policeman's ball is another one.
Or after Rotor recharges himself with a car battery.
Yeah.
And then the gas station attendant has a feats don't fail me now moment and like runs into a big pile of tires and then takes off down the street. From my interviews, I can't confirm this, but I'm going to assume that was improv, too. I'm going to go out on a limb.
That one I can see. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, not many movies can make Troll 2 look like Citizen Kane, but Rotor did a pretty good job of that, I thought. And now, Joe, you had a chance to talk to a couple people.
I did. I spoke to the associate producer, Stan Moore, who also did Weapons, and he did Stunts, and he did pretty much anything that they had come up with.
Wow.
At the last minute, and it's a very fascinating look into the making of a bad film and how you ultimately fail when you go in unprepared. Yeah, and it shows. I mean, you watch the movie and they're ill-prepared, and it is incompetent. And it is hilarious, but it is ultimately an all-around failure, even though they do boast the coming of Rotor 2 at the end. Did any of you have that pang of disappointment when you saw Rotor 2 and realized that it never did come to fruition?
Yeah, some people are still praying for it, I know. Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, I think our pal, our mutual friend Ken, who is Rotor aficionado number one,
yeah,
is the only one still with bated breath waiting for that eventual Rotor 2.
It could still happen. I'm sure she's still pumping weights in the gym getting ready for that role.
You go on the IMDb, you find out that she was in one other movie. She was in Flesh Gordon and the Cosmic Cheerleaders. Yeah, and her character name was apparently Mary Turd. Is this a career or what? I don't know. That's just really, really sad.
Hey, I got this great script for you. It's called Flesh Gordon and the Cosmic Cheerleaders. And
can I be a cheerleader? No, but you can be Mary Turd. Ah, nuts.
Rotor, the ruination of many a person.
This is perhaps the most controversial question regarding Rotor. Is this more a Terminator ripoff or a RoboCop ripoff?
I would go RoboCop. Yeah, I mean, Terminator wasn't out fighting crime. I mean, RoboCop was out fighting crime. It was kind of a half-human, half-machine hybrid. And I think Rotor has more similarities to that than he does time-traveling cyborg.
Yeah, I would go more in the opposite direction simply because Rotor does not do that much crime fighting. I mean, his creator is the foremost expert in police robotics, probably the only expert in police robotics. Right. But once Rotor is out, he makes a stop for speeding, for God's sake. Something that is designed to take on street crime and violence, and he pulls a guy over for speeding. Right. And shoots him. And then spends the rest of his career, i.e. this movie, chasing one woman, Sonia Guerin, and that's kind of close to Sarah Connor.
So maybe what you could say is that it pulls, like, the first half is kind of RoboCop-esque, mm-hmm. because like in RoboCop, I mean, he's created initially to fight crime. And then the second half, he becomes obsessed with this chasing down this girl, which is Terminator, so... Yeah, I guess it's kind of bold.
Yeah, I guess if you can point out one good thing about it, you know, if you really had to find it, if you took a magnifying glass and tweezers, it's a fact that there isn't a disconnect when it makes that switch.
Yeah.
It does seem like the same movie, terrible though it may be.
And, you know, I will admit that the movies and the characters themselves are perhaps better than Rotor, the movie, and the robot. Terminator's more menacing. Arnold definitely gives a more badass vibe. RoboCop is cool, has the badass gun, the shiny metal, etc. However, neither the Terminator nor RoboCop could see into the past.
That's true. That's where Rotor has him licked.
All he has to do is look at the person he's chasing, where they once were, and he can see into the past as to where they went and what happened.
Yeah, sensor recall is what shows up in the corner. And where is your techno babble now? Where is somebody explaining to me how the hell he can do that?
Sensor recall, or, if you prefer, idiot plot. Where you are just so goddamn lazy that you just need a plot device that is ridiculous and a slap to the face of every viewer who happens to watch your film. I remember the first time I saw the movie, I was like, what's going on? Because I know you alluded to this in an email, Freeman. Is he engaging a security camera? Is he watching? Like, no, he is seeing into the motherfucking past.
Yes, he is. He is seeing previous footage done in negative.
Last week on Rotor.
You didn't have so many security cameras and webcams back in 1988. That would have been cool if, you know. Yeah, if he had hacked into security cameras and stuff like that to see what was going on, but no, he's got magic robot vision. That's all there is to it.
Oh, Rotor, what could have been?
You crazy nutty bastard.
It did get the biggest laugh the first time I saw it. Hell, it almost got a standing O. It's loud laugh, the Napu Ultra of ridiculousness.
Now, I don't mean to whet your appetite, but I did address the problem of omniscient vision with Stan Moore while we discussed Rotor, and I'll save that for the interview. Oh, but
thank you for doing that. Thank you.
So, to wrap this up, I mean, we have a cornstache, chubby, killer robot who could see in the past, basically chasing a woman through the countryside while our quote-unquote heroes are at the hotel primping and getting their continental breakfast. They finally meet up at the end, and what you thought was unnecessary stump demolition in the beginning was clearly foreshadowing because, spoiler alert, they used the same deck cord to blow up the evil robot. Did they not, or did they
They used the debt cord. They called it primer cord, which it probably was in 88. And they said something about the power source setting it off because Dr. Steele, before she gets her back cracked by Rotor, manages to tear open his chest and expose the power source, apparently. This is the end result of two pieces of foreshadowing because go back to Shoe Boogie's scene. And he starts talking about the war eagle that the Native Americans used on their enemies, which was attaching every limb to a different horse and then having the horses go off in different directions. Because he's tied off one part of the debt cord to the car that Sharon is driving and sounding the horn on, and tied his other limbs to something else, and then he blows up, and it's a mess, but they got the war eagle in there.
Holy shit, you paid a lot of good attention to that movie.
That's why I make the big bucks, boy.
And with all due respect, fuck you. You go back to the Shoe Boogie scene.
Touché, sir. Well played.
So they finally blow up Rotor, and then Cold Iron is unceremoniously gunned down, leaving this police parking lot after giving him his statement. And then they forward his effects to some random nephew at the university. They allude to they figured out what was wrong with the initial Rotor, and that was it was a porn-stash chubby karate cop as opposed to a lesbian with a huge mohawk and abs the size of Texas. I guess making Rotor a woman for Rotor 2 will make a better police officer.
And a sense of mercy.
And a sense of mercy. And they tampered in God's domain.
And a brain.
Oh, God. The brain matrix. It's modeled after your own lower brain functions, without the higher functions to control them.
A brain without a heart. A conscious without recognition. A will without a soul.
If I miss, you'll be fighting your own base instincts. To combat pure will, you'll have to use pure illogic.
What do you mean?
You will have to allow yourself to fail. Use your failure against him. Your failure is his failure. Your weakness is his weakness. Then, only then can you do something.
Great, except I don't know what any of that means.
Let's hope you never have to find out.
The Noive. Yeah. Rotor, ladies and gentlemen, give it a hand.
And that about wraps up our thoughts, as convoluted as they were, on Rotor. Let's go ahead and cut to some of the minds behind the film itself. I had a chance to talk to both associate producer Stan Moore and actor Bill Blair, both actively participated, knowingly and willingly, in the 1988 opus Rotor. Let's take a listen.
So, what did Division Commander Bugler say?
Cold Iron's fired. I'm Project Chief now.
Huh?
I got 60 days.
60 days to what?
Well, to deliver product.
And that's impossible. It can't be done. Well, what if you don't deliver?
Then you're Project Chief.
You're gonna finish those fries?
Associate producer Stan Moore.
The three main guys were Cullen Blaine, he was the director, Richard Gershwin, who was the star guy who plays the star in it, you know, the guy that's the Cold Iron, and Buddy Lewis. Buddy was the writer. It was the three of them that came from L.A. and then Carroll, the guy that plays the robot. And so basically they came and they had 2 weeks to do pre-production to do this movie. And I was like, okay, that means like casting, locations, you know, everything. And, you know, they had, and their budget was like, I don't know, maybe $1 million. It was just something just outrageously small and insanely small. And so I was like, okay, well, this will be a challenge. This might be fun. I don't know. Maybe I can make it work. You know, and I said, okay, yeah, I've got, you know, friends and people I know I can get for casting. I've got some, you know, stunt guys. I think I can find a motorcycle for that. You know, basically I was doing everything I could to just help them get it done within their budget. And it was kind of a strange, you know, trio. Cullen, the director, basically he had like directed cartoons. He'd never directed like a, this is like his first debut to do like a live action movie. Okay. And Richard, the guy that was the actor, he had maybe, I don't know if he had ever acted anything to be truthful, but he was interested in the guy that got the people with the money. So he'd gotten the money together so he could basically be the star of a movie. Okay. And then Cullen knew Buddy. He'd written the script, and he was just like a great guy, and we worked a lot together. He actually let me do some of the storyboarding, and so that was kind of the setup. So then I did all the casting. So I'm doing this, and then it's like, well, we're going to need, you know, guns. And I'm like, okay, guns, all right. Well, I happened to, you know, once again, worked the last movie, the No Safe Haven, I worked with a guy named Randy Moore. He was actually a gun dealer that got into doing guns in movies. I mean, I remember we had like a 50 cal we used on that. He let me shoot it a couple times. You know, it's like one of these big old honkers with a tripod on it. It's like, man. And then we also learned how to use detcord. I don't know if you know what detcord is.
No, I have no idea. Unless that's what he blows the stump up in the beginning.
Right. That stuff is like, it's like a little cord, and you basically, all you do is you just put a, you know, blasting cap on it. And it's very loud. A lot of times people will use it just because it's so loud. You know, it's a mental thing. You know, you're having a big blast. You want it to sound good. I talked to Randy. He says, yeah, I can get you a couple of guns. I can help you out with that. Basically, he got me the Desert Eagle, I think, was the one that you saw. One of the worst days of my life was the scene at the gas station. The gun, some reason the gun was not firing blanks. So I had to figure out a way so I could have, you know, some gun, you know, smoke or something come out of the end. At that point, I think I'd been working like, you know, 14-hour days, brain scrambled. Not really thinking through it, I thought, I'll put a little gunpowder in there and a little cap inside of there and then basically just set it off. And it'll shoot some stuff out the end. Well, what I didn't realize was that the other end, I should have tested it, which I didn't, but what happened was it backfired into the actor's eye, Richard's eyes. And he was essentially blind for like several hours. I lost it, man, because I'm like, am I blind in this guy, man? What have I done, man? A mixture of all the pressure and everything just kind of hit, and when that thing happened, I was like, because some other things had gone wrong that I'd kind of screwed up on, and I had to do squibs on this one guy, and we had to do that. And remember the scene where it's at the other gas station where the big trucker guy, the big guy gets out, and he's like, and he gets shot. That coat that he wears is actually the same coat that Schwarzenegger wore in Terminator, if you can believe that. That was one of the things Buddy had actually worked some on Terminator, had gotten that coat.
So that's the actual coat Schwarzenegger wore?
Yeah, one of the coats that he wore.
Wow.
One of the squibs didn't have enough backing on this guy, and it burned him on his chest. And so that was, I mean, it wasn't like a major league deal, but still it was like, man, that's a screw up, you know, it shouldn't have happened. His eyes cleared up and he was okay, but man, I thought for a while, I just thought maybe if I'd done, you know, what have I done? So like I said, I ended up doing like, you know, special effects, like the deal with the stumps. I set that thing up out there and we blew that thing off. And so anyway, that was kind of the whole deal with that, which once again, it was craziness just getting through the movie, you know, and shooting at nights, and well, you know, it was kind of those deals that you have any kind of movie set, you're going to have things happen to go wrong, you're going to have people get mad at each other. Now, one of the funniest things that happened, I'm not sure at what point it happened, but Cullen and Richard had a major falling out, basically. And I think it may have been after the effect LA or, you know, somewhere on the set at some point. But what happened was Cullen got so ticked off at Richard that You know, if you watch the movie, he dubbed his entire voice. The reason he did that was because he didn't think he sounded that great, for one, but he wasn't that great an actor. He was so pissed off, rather than having Richard come in and redo, you know, whatever lines and dub, he just hired another guy to do the whole thing. He did all the post in L.A. We, you know, we shot the whole movie there in the Dallas, Fort Worth area. I actually broke my collarbone, which I still have. It still sticks out, right, because I was doubling on the motorcycle up until that happened. It's the scene where we come out of the, basically he just got recharged and he comes blasting out of that, gas station and onto the road. Well, when I came out, the first time I did it, you know, it was okay. They said, oh, that's good. Can you do it again? Give us, you know, make it a little more exciting. I said, sure. That bike happened to have a turbo. It was a 650 Yamaha Seca. When I was coming out the second time, I hit the power band at just the right way, and the turbo kicked just as I was going from the gravel to the cement, and it just spit me high side of me right over the top. Oh, crap, this hurts. And basically, I'd separated my shoulder like 6 months before, so I went for the x-ray. The doctor said, oh, you just separated your shoulder. I was like, wait, I think this collarbone's broke. No. I'm like, it was broken. It still sticks out to this day. But like the next day after that, I had to play the scene of the doctor with the robot standing there in that lab coat, man. I'm like, got pain pills going, oh crap, man. Trying not to move my right arm as little as possible because it was sore, it was hurt.
Now, how was it acting the vast majority of your screen time opposite a wisecracking French fry eating robot with a police hat?
Oh, yeah. How was it?
Yeah, did that challenge you as an actor?
You know. Not really. It was just fun. I mean, and Buddy was doing the guys the lines, you know. So sometimes he would say stuff that would crack me up. We would, like, you know, have to, you know, start over, you know, retake. But it was a lot of fun. I actually came up with the line, the robot, are you gonna eat those fries? He was really cool about that because I would suggest stuff, and he was not like, oh, that sucks. Or he'd go, yeah, or he'd go, well, maybe next time or something, you know.
Was it your idea to put, like, the Simon face on him and put a police hat on top of his head?
No. That was actually, that robot is an actual robot that the Addison Police Department uses to go and talk to kids. They found that kids, which is amazing, they found that kids will actually open up and talk to that robot more than they would to a real live officer. You know, some problem at home and being, you know, beaten or molested or whatever, the kid would actually talk to the robot and they could get information that they needed. Making a movie is like fighting a war. It really is. It's a battle because there's always things that are going to go wrong. And if you don't delegate properly and have, you know, good people, you know, under you, and if you don't, I mean, the hardest part too is when you're trying to do things without any money. And if you don't, you know, if you don't do proper pre-production, then you really get, you know, you get your, you back yourself into a hole. You know, in other words, if you have money, you can buy your way out a lot of things. If you have a problem, you know, well, let's just throw money at this, which, well, a lot of budgets, when they go up high and go, you know, through the roof, that's what's happened, is things have gone wrong. And I've learned that, you know, from years as production. I just, when I go into production, I know something's going to go wrong. So I'm just mentally prepared that I don't freak out, stay on schedule, you know, and keep moving.
I'm assuming the release of RoboCop 1 year prior was no coincidence.
That was no coincidence. You are correct, sir. This was RoboCop Cheapo Robo. Yeah. I mean, when they first came in, they said, we're doing a low budget version of RoboCop. And I was like, you know, and Buddy and I talked about this too. If Cullen would have had a sense of humor, we could have made it just funny. And it could have been just, I mean, it could have been, you know, like a Zuckerman film, if you know, like an airplane, if we would have really just taken it and had fun with it. Yeah, it was one of the craziest things I've ever done in my life, to be truthful. It was wild.
Oh, hey, Captain Colhart, sir. I need to get you down to the range and qualify. It's that time again.
What's that, Statham? You want me to go out and shoot targets now? Out to the range? You getting in my face about this, Statham? Right now? Is that what you want? Huh?
No. Forget it. I'll just write it in, sir. No need to bother. I'll just send over another sharpshooter medal. That's all, sir.
Actor Bill Blair.
I kind of tell people Roeder was a little bit of a predecessor to RoboCop.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Roeder came out a year after RoboCop. Is that correct?
It came out, right after, but it was actually filmed before it.
Oh, really?
Because I worked on RoboCop as well. I did both of them when I was in Dallas. Well, Roeder, as you know, as you've watched it, had more of that B-movie feel to it, almost a little bit of a throwback to 1960s style filmmaking to me. It didn't have the strongest characters, you know, involved. As a matter of fact, I thought the fact that they hired me to play Statham was very interesting. You know, this firing range officer who's a member of the police force that had hair clear down past his collar. I thought that alone made it comical. The end fact was that he ended up doing, you know, covering that scene ended up getting edited with a lot more of me than there really should have been, because Cold Iron just did not come across the way he needed to. And the fact was, when they were editing it, and I guess Colin Blaine, when he looked at it, thought, you know, my character was just so animated. It basically needed to be seen. It in itself created this particular moment where Cold Iron was just fuming, and my reaction sold his personality, his character at that time, better than showing him, I guess. They got me in and out fairly quickly that day. That particular scene we shot at the Dallas World Trade Center, which is why it had a more modernistic feel to it. It was the glass, you know, steel type building with all the white and chrome. And I don't remember what level we shot on, but at the top of that scene, for example, where it's supposed to be almost like I'm playing a video console before he passes me and I turn to catch his attention, all I'm really doing is making sounds with my own voice as I'm looking at a floor directory. I mean, that's one of those little bit of behind the scenes tidbits that nobody else would know. I've never even told anybody to this point about anything like that. Of course, you're the first ones to actually ever talk to me about that movie. That was supposed to be some futuristic, you know, video game, and all that was me making voices away from camera. The console below me literally was a map of that floor as a directory as to what offices were where. And then I turned to him, and then that's it. And I think my whole scene, once we got started, I think my whole that whole thing didn't take but maybe an hour to shoot. I really had no problems with Colin. Colin seemed to be very pleased with what I was doing. I don't think we did more than 5 or 6 takes at the most. You know, minor adjustments here and there. Nothing sticks out in my mind that, you know, he was hard to work with. But again, like I said, being one of the actors who's there for just a short period of time, I might have been treated differently than, you know, other crew or actors that were there, you know, day in and day out. And these were my very early days in the business. I got into the business in Chicago in fall of 1982, spring of 83, and by fall of 84, I had moved to Dallas, and it was in 85 that we shot both Rotor and RoboCop, I believe.
And now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Well, fellas, you know what that means. It's time to hit the lights and close up shop for this week. Creeper, anything before we go?
Rotor, check it out. Fuck you, Jeff and Freeman.
Dr. Freaks, anything before we wrap up?
Ignore that man behind the curtain. Don't check out Rotor.
I concur, sir. Well, guys, don't forget to check out DailyGrindhouse.com 3, 4, 5 times a day. Don't miss a thing. And follow us on Twitter, where you can find us on the handle @DailyGrindhouse. Next time, we're going to be classing up the joint a little bit with Shogun Assassins, so sharpen the blades. Get ready to get bloody. And until then, for Dr. Freaks and the Creeper, this is G. Here's to good watching this week. Salute, bastards.
Now, I do have one last thing. I have one viewer-submitted question, and I'm actually reading this verbatim. He actually sounds a little perturbed. I don't know what Rotor ever did to him, but it's kind of an interesting question. It says, okay, seriously, I like sci-fi. I'm a sci-fi guy. I'm pretty much down with what they are trying to do, but the robo-magic vision that allows it to see events in the past, were they ever at least ashamed of that? Did they ever kick around possible explanations like liberating trapped photons from inanimate objects in the vicinity to create the images? but decide whether the explanation was too bizarre or too cumbersome just to cut it. So I guess he has a problem with Rotor being able to see in the past.
Yeah, I have a problem with that too, telling him. I was just there for the ride.